20 years ago, you had to put on a trench coat and go to a corner store and sneak to the back room while everybody judged you for being there, and then slip a magazine into your coat and covertly pay for it and then leave and look at your porn. Now you need to pull out your phone when you have 3 spare minutes and look up whatever type of depravity you happen to be into.
A new tool in the fight against pornography. On the news portion of the program, a new policy in Ontario that essentially quashes the conscience rights of doctors. Also, a look at ARPA's influence at the annual Manning Center Networking Conference in Ottawa. A bit more reflection on both the Carter case and Ontario's new sex ed curriculum. And an update on the so-called bathroom bill.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
It appears the so-called conscience rights issue for doctors has been settled in Ontario. And the final decision is not good news for Christians who practice medicine there. The College of Physicians and Surgeons, which regulates the practice of medicine, released a new policy late Friday which says doctors will not be allowed to withhold certain medical services, such as abortion or doctor-assisted suicide, even if those practices are against their conscience or religious beliefs. The new policy says doctors must provide care in an emergency, in a situation to prevent imminent harm, even where that care conflicts with their conscience or religious beliefs. It's the term imminent harm that isn't defined. There's concern it could include a woman's mental anguish over having to wait for an abortion, or physical pain endured by a patient who wants help in committing suicide. In what are presumably non-imminent cases, doctors will have an out, sort of. They won't necessarily have to perform the procedures themselves, but they will have to refer patients who ask for those services to other doctors who'd be willing to perform them. The policy doesn't say how that might play out in small towns where there might not be any doctors available to perform the requested procedures. We'll have a follow-up to this story next week. In other news, hundreds of conservatives from across the country converged on the Ottawa Convention Center last week for the annual Manning Center Networking Conference. ARPA was there with 2 booths, one for ARPA itself, the other for the We Need a Law component. Executive Director Mark Penninga says it's important to be at events like this.
This is our opportunity to remind the conservative coalition in Canada that we do need to consider these deeper questions. We introduce them to specifically biblical perspectives on some of these key policy issues, and that's not something that's here otherwise. There's a table here from the Christian Heritage Party. There's a couple of think tanks that are Christian. But otherwise, it's definitely a unique voice that we're presenting at this conference.
Petnicka says a keynote speech from CBC broadcaster and National Post columnist Rex Murphy on Friday illustrated why it's important for ARPA to be here.
He did a really good job encouraging conservatives to not just dig deeper, but to be braver, to fight against political correctness, and to look to these higher principles that makes us truly Canadian. But I was struck because there's a recognition that we need to do this for the sake of things like virtue, but what was lacking specifically was, where does that come from? Where do we find that foundation? And that's something that ARPA points to, that foundation, that virtue, the standard of what allows society to really work, ultimately comes from living the way God wants us to live. So pretty neat that we can provide that specifically Christian voice in a conference like this.
As for response to the booth?
If people actually take the time to stop to look at the publications, they are interested and they appreciate the fact that we dig deeper. There's so much of politics today that's shallow, superficial, cynical, and when they look at our stuff, they see right away that these are the real issues and that we're engaging on them in a way that's real. Hopefully they also see true, but we work on just having that conversation with them.
Lots of talk on the conference floor about the 2 big issues we've been following here at Lighthouse News for the past few weeks, the Carter decision on doctor-assisted suicide and Ontario's new sex ed curriculum. On the Carter case, Nicholas Steinhardt from the group Living with Dignity says they've had their lawyers go over the Supreme Court decision, and they've come up with a bit of a surprising conclusion.
When we take it apart, we realize that they really aren't opening the door to euthanasia. It's really about assisted suicide. So we're working on publishing that analysis in the next few days. But I think it's important to realize that it's not quite as open as people initially thought, and it's certainly not as open as pro-euthanasia people would like us to believe.
So why is the distinction between euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide important at all?
First of all, it's a question of numbers. There's less people that are likely to ask assisted suicide than euthanasia. The other aspect is a question of giving people the tools to kill themselves, whereas euthanasia is killing someone. And when we're talking about a doctor actually killing a patient, it completely denatures the meaning of healthcare.
The Living with Dignity group says it's putting together suggested guidelines for how the Supreme Court ruling should be applied in practice. Among the ideas they're promoting is the notion that it should be at least as difficult to have a doctor-assisted suicide approved as it is to get someone declared mentally incompetent, that at very least there should be a judicial review of each case. On the Ontario Sex Ed curriculum, the Institute for Marriage and Families has been going over the several hundred pages released at Queen's Park late last month. Senior researcher Peter John Mitchell says the problems with the curriculum's age-inappropriate content have been well documented, but there's really a broader concern, and that has to do with the role of the state in bringing up children.
For instance, there's a lot in the curriculum, particularly in grades 7 and 8, about forming identity, forming a self-concept, and that's not just sexual identity, that's the whole overall concept. So one thing that parents could be asking themselves is it appropriate for the state to be taking the lead on leading kids through discovering who they are? And I think there's going to be different influences. There's going to be faith influences, parents. There's going to be influence from schools and teachers as well. But I think the curriculum is clearly set up to put the educator in the lead of that process. And even does that even make practical sense when we have kids that are going to be with different teachers every year? In many cases, you know, they might have a special teacher for phys ed and a different teacher for that. Like, our school system isn't really built up relationally to develop those kinds of attachments and bonds where self-development actually really happens.
As to what parents can do to deal with this, he says it'll really come down to the relationships they have with their children's teachers.
Where I think it's really going to come down to the nuts and bolts is next fall, when parents are engaging teachers and hopefully doing that in a respectful manner. But I think parents have the right to know what's going on in the classroom. And I think it's actually in the classroom in the teacher's best interest to share what's going on before they get to those lessons. And in some ways, that takes away some of the anxiety for parents. In other ways, I think it just allows parents to be able to deal with those aspects at home or to make a decision whether they feel it's appropriate to remove their child from that class.
Mitchell says the problem with that is that a lot of the curriculum is embedded throughout the entire course load, so it'll be difficult for parents to pull their kids out of specific parts of what's being taught. Equally, he says, parents should not discount the influence they have on their kids, even their teenagers, when it comes to these issues.
Parents are the primary sex educators. Whatever is taught in the curriculum, we know from whether it's peer-reviewed data, whether it's surveys of students, that parents are the primary influencers in terms of their child's sexual decision-making. Sex education, I think, is one tool. I often think of it as the dull arrow in the quiver. It's one tool, but it's not the sharpest tool that we have. And parents will always be influential more than they know.
In other news, it looks like the so-called transgender bill that was before the Senate isn't going to pass into law before this fall's election. You'll recall that earlier this year we spoke with Senator Don Platt about this. The bill is the one which, among other things, would allow people who self-identify as transgendered to use whichever public washroom they choose, male or female. That's how the bill got to be nicknamed the bathroom bill. Platt told us at the time he was going to propose amendments to ensure that the bill included exemptions where the safety of women or young girls might be compromised. Those amendments passed in the Senate. The bill is now back before the House, which will likely run out of time to consider the amendments before the writ drops this fall. Back with more after this.
Please save the date for the National March for Life in Ottawa on Thursday, May 14th. We will be sending more details in the coming weeks, so if you don't already receive our emails, please sign up at arpacanada.ca. We hope to see you in Ottawa for the Reformed Prayer Service and March for Life on Thursday, May 14th.
And we're back on the program. With me today is Jonathan Van Maren. We're talking about a new initiative on pornography in Canada. It's called Strength to Fight. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on, Al.
Talk to me a little bit about this initiative. Looks fairly new. I had a look at your website. You just had an event in Calgary recently. What are you doing? What's it all about?
Well, it's brand new, but it's had six talks in its first week of existence. Basically, over the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot more talks on sexuality and pornography because it's a growing problem, and especially here in our reform communities, people really want to talk about this issue, but there's not a lot of people willing to. So over time, as I was writing articles on pornography, we decided that Canada really needed an anti-porn initiative because the problem is enormous. Like 83% of men are looking at porn at least twice a month. But there's no organization that's specifically oriented towards addressing this problem, making sure that people get the right help that they need, making sure that people get their addictions broken when they want to, helping girls and women, for example, who are in relationships with porn addicts. So basically what myself and Josh and Daniel Gilman decided to do was to launch a nonprofit organization explicitly oriented towards getting rid of the porn problem in Canada to the best that we possibly could. So we set up this new organization, and we've just been overwhelmed by speaking requests and information requests and advice requests because the need out there is so great. People out there realize that porn is an enormous problem. It's affecting the lives of literally every single one of your listeners, whether they know it or not, and it's something that we have to stand up and face.
Is it becoming more mainstream? I'm thinking, you know, the recent release of 50 Shades of Grey, which essentially, even the feminists are saying, you know, this is pornography.
Well, they are now, which is great. The book sold 100 million copies, and then it turned into a blockbuster film. Well, it certainly is, and there's a number of reasons for that, right? Like, 20 years ago, you had to put on a trench coat and go to a corner store and sneak to the back room while everybody judged you for being there, and then slip a magazine into your coat and covertly pay for it, and then leave and look at your porn. Now you need to pull out your phone when you have 3 spare minutes and look up whatever type of depravity you happen to be into. And I mean that when I say it. I was speaking at a Christian school conference some time ago, and I had 13, 14-year-olds asking me about, like, very specific types of bestiality that I had never even heard of. Like, the kids that I'm speaking to, for the most part, know far more about porn than I do. It's just their teachers and their parents that don't know what I'm talking about. One of the reasons it's so mainstream is because people can access it without anybody knowing, and we can't defend people from it because, as my colleague Josh says, even if you're not looking for porn, porn is trying to find you. Porn is trying to find you on your phone, on your iPad, on your laptop. The porn industry is quite well aware of what they need to do to get you hooked, and they're trying to do it. The porn companies are actively trying to seek young people out on their cell phones and their iPads and their mobile devices, especially using pop-up ads.
What are the long-term implications of this? I mean, we have, it's been described to me as one of the more sexualized societies out there, particularly in terms of our young people, because they're so savvy on the internet and on social media. What's this going to look like in terms of our society in 10, 15, 20 years when these kids become parents?
Well, we don't even have to ask ourselves what it's going to look like because we see it already. 56% of divorce cases in the United States now explicitly cite porn in the divorce papers as one of the reasons for that divorce, because guys are growing up with porn. And they're now thinking that the admission of thousands upon thousands of naked people into their marriage is something that should just be accepted. Girls, by and large, are still opposed to this, even though there's enormous cultural pressure for them just to accept it. And this is having a huge problem with the marriages. This is why I always said when churches didn't want to address the issue, and my friends would ask me, well, when do you think the churches will start talking about it? I said, when the couple starts showing up in the pastor's office. Because this problem eventually is going to end up in the pastor's office, in the marriage counselor's office, and in the divorce court proceedings, because it destroys marriages. And it's even more serious than that, because the bottom line is that porn does fuel rape culture, being defined as a culture that systematically trivializes sexual assault. Well, if you look at this culture where 83% of men are viewing porn multiple times a month, and 88% of the mainstream porn films include explicit violence, 49% include extraordinarily crude name-calling, we have got a society that's consuming essentially rape and sexual assault for recreation and entertainment. And you should hear the stories that I get to hear at high schools. It's brutal. One girl, when we were talking to her outside her high school, just basically said, like, you have no idea what boys are like these days, because you've got a generation of boys, many of them from divorced homes. They never had a father who taught them how to treat girls or about healthy sexuality. He learns about sex from porn. This is what we're finding. The average first exposure to porn is age 11. He thinks that's real sex. And more than that, he thinks violent sex is real sex. And he goes into a relationship thinking these things. There are boys out there that I know that are rapists and don't even know it yet, because they're doing things that they think are normal, not realizing that they're actually extraordinarily violent. And then you've got girls who have the same thing. They come in from broken families. They often have not received the masculine attention in a father or good brothers that they deserved. And as a result of that, they're looking for masculine attention in, as you know, the song puts it, all the wrong places. And this girl, this insecure girl, will end up in a relationship with the boy I just described. And it's a match made in hell, and everything goes wrong. And, you know, to go back to your very first question, her mother is reading 50 Shades of Grey, and she now thinks that she has to put up with violence in the sexual context, in the romantic context, because clearly her mom considers that type of thing erotica, and what is a girl of that age to do? And that's the kind of questions I'm getting from young girls. Like, is this okay? Like, am I supposed to let my boyfriend do this? The answer is, of course, no, but he's watching violent porn and her mom is reading 50 Shades of Grey, and the whole culture, the media, the TV industry, the film industry, and the music industry are all teaching her that her value is in her sexual output. So we have a really, really lost generation, and that's why saying the fight is so essential.
It's a pretty dark picture you're painting. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Is there some way out of this?
Yeah, there is. And the difference between porn and a lot of other social issues that you and I would agree on is that the secular media is actually recognizing just how brutal it is. So we've got the anti-Christian, very left-wing comedian Russell Brand putting out what was quite a brilliant video on pornography, just explaining the impact that pornography had on himself. We've got Gentleman's Quarterly discussing how porn isn't wrong. It was an article called The Reasons You Should Stop Looking at Porn. This is like Cosmopolitan giving you 10 reasons to be abstinent. It's sort of unheard of. Even mainstream Hollywood has been producing movies that would encourage no one to watch that do critique porn and actually talk about porn as a net negative for any romantic relationship. So the sexual revolution that brought us pornography has a really awful report card, but the media is actually starting to report on certain aspects of this. And while the damage porn has done can't be undone to a large degree, at the same time, moving forward, we can help to mitigate and limit this threat, protect as many relationships as we possibly can, and protect as many young people as we possibly can. And the encouraging thing I would give to your listeners is that I do talks on pornography in high schools and churches all the time, and every single time I do, I've got a lineup of young men who say, how do I get off this stuff? How do I quit?
The final question would be, what do you tell those young men when they come to you? How do I get off this stuff?
Well, it's the same answer you'd give a smoker, whatever it takes. You know, I smoked cigarettes on and off for 8 years, so I understand addiction. And I know what it's like to know that something's bad for you, but still go back to it. So when they actually come up and they say, I want to quit pornography, they have to be willing to do what it takes to quit pornography. And the bottom line is that it's going to be inconvenient, irritating, and it's going to slow them down. Because what you have to do is you've got to put an accountability filter, not just on your laptop, but especially on your phone and your iPad. You've got to have people that are receiving your report each week. That person should actually be keeping you accountable, should be, you know, giving you a call, and not just calling you when you screw up, making sure that you're staying away from it. You should be telling people in your life, telling people that, okay, like, look, I've got this problem, and I want to be held accountable, and I want to get rid of this habit, so please help me do it. And a lot of guys feel very alone in their problem because they don't know the 80% stat. Chances are everybody that they're afraid to tell has looked or is looking at porn themselves. So accountability is enormous. It's like somebody else is in the room. Addictions flourish in privacy. And one of the reasons that porn has flourished is because you don't have to go through that scenario I described earlier with, you know, the trench coat in the corner store and the shame. You've got to boot up your phone when nobody's looking over your shoulder. So an accountability program is like somebody is in fact looking over your shoulder. And that cuts out the porn rate enormously right off the bat.
Jonathan, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Al.
For more information on this topic, or if you'd like to book Jonathan to speak to your church or youth group, check strengthtofight.ca.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Production manager, Brian Grimm. Technical director, Nate Boscher. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpaccanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.